Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to New Books in Technology. You know, one of the things that has been common since the advent of the perhaps commercial web is the idea of how to conceptualize it, and to conceptualize it for many purposes, to think about policy, to think about law, to think about culture. And you know what? This is one of the things we're going to talk about today. And to assist us with our conversation, we have Payal Arora, who is an assistant professor at Erasmus University in the Netherlands. She's also the author of the new book, The Leisure Commons, A Spatial History of Web 2.0. So, Payal, thank you for coming on the show.
Thank you, Jasmine, for having me on.
You know, one of the first things we like to do on the show is to just give the authors time to do an introduction of themselves. So please tell us, what is your background as far as how did you get into the study of Web 2.0 and language literacy and technology and all those things?
Okay, that sounds rather broad. Okay. I'm from India. I mean, particularly Bangalore. A lot of people know it as the Silicon Valley of India. And so I grew up there and moved to San Francisco just in time when they were, you know, churning out those T-shirts of don't get Bangalorized. So it was nice to know that they knew about us. So I spent about 16 years in the U.S. and now in the Netherlands. So it's sort of intuitive for me to approach any subject really in a sort of comparative global lens. Mm-hmm. I started really getting interested in technology when I got this sort of project as a master's student to go to a rural part of India to, you know, sort of check out what Hewlett Packard was doing. They were supposed to wire a village and make it a sort of digital village, you know, for the new century. And it was just an excuse to see a part of India that I wasn't really engaged in because I grew up in the city. Mm-hmm. And that really got me interested in how people were using new media technologies, even in the most remote, poor, marginalized areas. I mean, we had, like, I would see these farmers, instead of checking crop prices, they were, like, downloading, you know, Bollywood stars, and they were photoshopping that. And so it was really fun. And it's not just the Web 2.0, but the leisure aspect of 2.0. Mm-hmm. So I've been doing that for, let's say, a decade of deep ethnography work. And so this has been quite a shift. You know, this book is really a more sociological book because I think every anthropologist should be a sociologist at some point. Mm-hmm. So because it's really allows you to step back and say, okay, now where does it fit in the bigger picture, right? Right. How does this compare to other settings? This is where the journey started.
Mm-hmm. Now, the book, The Leisure Commons, A Spatial History of Web 2.0, what made you write this specific book?
Unsurprisingly, the inspiration came from a park. I remember clearly the time when this happened because I was a student at Columbia University in New York, and I would escape to Riverside Park and, you know, do my usual jogging. And, you know, as doctoral students do, they think about everything but the topic of dissertation. So I was thinking about why do people, you know, somehow organize themselves? I mean, how do they know what to do in a park? There's no, it's not really regulated. How do they know where to picnic, where to walk, how to, you know, how to behave in these seemingly open spaces? And particularly when it gets violated, then people sort of, you know, chastise them. And this was also, remember, at that time, it was the rise of Facebook. It was literally 1 year later, Facebook had come up, and other social network sites are really exponentially growing. So it was one of those fun things that my friends and I would get together and say, okay, I know it sounds kind of nerdy, but actually the fun things for doctoral students, let me clarify, and say, okay, let's compare a Web 2.0 space with, you know, a park space. I just would put that out, and people would come up with speaker's corners and saying, oh, look at the speaker's corner in Hyde Park and how that could be like Twitter. And, you know, in terms of its potential for protest, these sort of hashtag public, many other different examples start coming. And what I found really cool was even people who kind of not into Web 2.0 stuff or new media stuff really got engaged in talking about, you know, these social spaces, because of course they are engaged with parks. Everybody is a park expert, so to speak, right? So that was what sort of clicked us. Oh, people wouldn't mind having a conversation. They relate to parks in a very deep, intuitive sense. And why not sort of leverage on that and apply it to the so-called novel, unprecedented digital space? So that's how it really began.
Great. And so you call it the leisure commons. And I wonder about the term leisure, because sometimes we think of leisure, I think people think of play or relaxation. And yet we've seen many parts of Web 2.0 as far as social media become very unrelaxed, if I had to use that word, you know, fraught with either hate speech, as some people classify it, or as you were just talking about, activism or hashtag activism or hacking. So I'm wondering, like, how the leisure, is there a conflict with that term leisure, or has leisure expanded?
It's a great question. And basically, that is actually the purpose of using the term. And I have to say that it's not the most marketable term. People don't use that. Like, they sort of stay away from the topic of leisure in new media studies. They're like, oh, isn't that something really peripheral? I mean, aren't you going off the subject?
Right.
And so, but the thing is that we have so much data to prove. I mean, it is a fact that what majority of people are doing online, not just, by the way, in the West, but also across emerging markets, are primarily social and leisure purposes of play, entertainment, you know, connecting socially, just hanging out, browsing aimlessly. And these sort of leisure activities, like the top sites, the social network sites, pornography sites, they're being experienced across the world. And so I really want to deliberately situate leisure at the center, not on the periphery, because that's what we are doing. And within these activities, starting to say, okay, let's problematize these. Let's connect these innocuous, so-called innocuous spaces with really deeply resonant and contentious politics, such as, like, and when you go into park literature, there's this rich, you know, breadth of how parks appear to be innocent, leisurely, innocuous, but actually were deeply political, and were the key grounds for social resistance, were highly branded publics, like, say, fantasy parks, driven by the media empire. So you start off with something which appears unproblematic, and then you start to unravel it, because, and then we can see the same thing with the sort of rhetoric and hype of Web 2.0, you know, of these participatory cultures, these leisure activities. So yeah, you can't separate the two. That's what I mean. It's leisure and labor, leisure and protest. I want to create these linkages very deeply across, right?
Absolutely. And so I'm wondering also, and I think you touched on this in the book, if we think about the park, and in the United States, we think of perhaps park systems, whether through counties or the federal parks. I'm wondering if, like parks, the web started off with, you know, one purpose. So Facebook was connecting students across campuses, right? And then the purpose changed, or how their use changed. And I'm wondering if that is like the analog park, and why do you think that is?
Oh, I love this, the analog park. I like that term. you should find that now. I would say that's one of the, like, I start off with that, is saying that when parks were a radical conceptualization of the 1900s, mm-hmm. and imagine in those days, there were the imperial powers, the royalty. And at that time, the idea that the masses could have a space for no other purpose but for their social and leisure purposes in the heart of a city was radical. It was unprecedented. There was a deep ideology driving this. It was also partly the movement of urbanization, you know, and creation into the city. So you had these diverse groups of people coming together and deep tensions, and the state had to, whether the state in the US or the imperial powers in China or the royalty in the UK, they had to come up with a sort of safety valve to allow these very differentiated publics to work together. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, they couldn't actually control and order them. In fact, if we look at the history of Beijing parks, the state didn't necessarily resist it. They were the main drivers of this because they wanted to signal to the world that they were, you know, they had arrived on the modernity stage. They also wanted to show to their public that they really were deeply paternalistic, that they were out there to shape them and to really so-called civilize them, you know, socialize them, you know, as a new modern citizen. Mm-hmm. So that's how the architecture of the Beijing parks, for example, came to be. Or if you say it's the same kind of conversation you'll see in Hyde Park and by the royalty in England, or in the Massachusetts parks by the state governments of that time, is how do we control these, you know, so-called uncivilized public? How do we socialize them? It's time to take them to a new era. So it's a similar rhetoric you see in Web 2.0, where it was, you know, coming from the military and the government, mm-hmm. and the idea was to make the government more accessible, you know, make society more orderly. And as things have it, is intent and practice don't often go hand in hand.
Right.
So if you look at what happened with Beijing parks, was the public used them as sites of resistance. There were massive protests, which really surprised, actually. I'm surprised that they were surprised, but it was, you know, it surprised them, the imperial powers, because they thought, oh, wouldn't they be satisfied with this new space that we're gifting them? And they even opened up library corners and, you know, healthcare centers within the park to, as ways of sort of a more utilitarian means. But these guys wanted to, the public at that time wanted to just really engage in multiple activities, come together, you know, address issues that were deeply socially oppressive. So, yeah, it was one of the pivotal points where, you know, social movements and protest movements sprung up within these sites. So there's a long history of parks as sites of resistance, and that's what I find so exciting, that the intent was to socialize them, but the endpoint was often of resistance and, you know, modification of these sort of primal architectures. Right?
Mm-hmm. Now, in the book, you go through a lot of different parks or different kinds of parks. So you have walled gardens, you have corporate parks and fantasy parks, and protest parks, and you talk about the difference between all of these and how Web 2.0 relates to all of these different kinds of parks. So my question is, when I think of parks, obviously I'm coming from a very Western and American perspective, and I think of the difference between the different kinds of parks just from my experience, where I think of the county or city-run system, very urban parks set aside for space, and the county goes through and mows the lawns and opens and closes the swimming pools. And then I think of the federal parks, which are just huge swaths of land set aside supposedly for conservation purposes and to maintain the beauty of, you know, the country, but also allow people to use them and, you know, camping and things of that nature. And they can't really regulate what goes on totally, although they can put up rules and hope to stop people from doing certain things. So when I think about Web 2.0, I'm wondering, is regulation at all possible with these kinds of spaces? So we can try, and we've seen countries attempt to shut off the internet and social media, but at least with parks, I guess you can shut down the park. Can you really shut down the park with Web 2.0?
You know, let's actually just to clarify the sort of metaphor here is that, you know, urban parks were used as a metaphor because it was a very concerted action and a concerted architecting of public space for purposes. So just like Web 2.0, it was a carving of the larger internet ethos, right? Mm-hmm. So they seem like they both share this rhetoric of they both are supposed to be free for all, democratic, open, and actually they're omnipresent, they're across the world. Now, in terms of regulation, in terms of how are they architected, can they be really architected, is I think a good example of this chapter I go into called Walled Gardens is the fact is that in tech speak, they use the metaphor of walled gardens, and it says a lot. It actually goes back to the urban planning, urban park literature, because when you look at how they define walled gardens in new media spaces, it's really about closing these information spaces by certain providers. And that is, you know, for the sake, I mean, at least in the name of protection, security for the customer, for the consumer, right? Mm-hmm. And it was a similar sort of logic for walled gardens of the past. Gramercy Park, for example, in New York is a good case in point. In 1800s, Gramercy Park came up, and even though the park was supposed to be for the public, it was actually, you know, the subtext was for the appropriate public. So you actually needed a key to get in there. You had to open the gates, and often the people who had the key were the people who were wealthy and lived around that area. In fact, even if you don't even need those kind of, you know, strong regulations to regulate a space like that, because most of how people are governed are from informal rules, right? Mm-hmm. Like, in park spaces, it was understood that women couldn't enter like in Moscow parks, women could not enter those parks without being accompanied by the males. And often in the evening for marital purposes, there were very deep regulations of homosexuals couldn't just congregate, and a number of social rules were architecting those spaces. But it has opened up. And I would say that, you know, as a sort of a subversive activity, you see that even in the history of parks, that homosexuals did use these parks for the very, you know, activities which were condemned. Mm-hmm. And we have a wonderful literature on that, is how, like, look at the Ramble, in Central Park, it was made for the wealthy around Central Park, where it became a hotbed for homosexuality. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I mean, we have a number of those examples, but I would say that regulation is key here. And one of my favorite, of course, examples in this is the like button, right, on Facebook. Mm-hmm. Every time you like something, you automatically are becoming a member of a particular zone and a particular group. And much like what's happening today with gated communities, where people are choosing to live within particular confines, mm-hmm. and the logic being that you can really be free when you have certain borders around that freedom. Mm-hmm. So it's a good conversation. I think worth thinking about is the relationship between regulation and freedom.
Mm-hmm. You know, one of the ideas surrounding public parks is the idea that this is the citizens of that city or county's park, right? So there's the idea of ownership underlying the public spaces and public parks. Is that a dangerous kind of idea for people to have with respect to the web, an idea of ownership of information or ownership of certain spaces that are a lot of times very corporate and therefore kind of private, even though used for or open for the public? So Facebook is considered kind of a public space, although it's hosted by a very private corporation. And yet there's this idea of ownership. This is my Facebook page, or this is my Tumblr page, or my Twitter. Is that a...
Yeah, I mean, that's the best strategy when you believe that you own something, just, you know, when you believe it is public, but actually is private, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, it's fun to see the sort of evolution of metaphors. You know, how the sort of naive, like the old internet is a wild, wild west, or the western frontier. So it's like everybody, whoever reaches there can own it. You can take a little slice of it. I mean, that was the first, you know, era of ideology dominating the internet. And today you hear more of the walled garden, semi-private spaces that you're talking about, right? Mm-hmm. That kind of... metaphor is dictating it. And so, yeah, I would say that it definitely is much more privatized. Like, let's take a good example here is Disneyland. Mm-hmm. I'd say that's a good comparison. Is these are very privatized spaces in some sense. But when you go into Disneyland, once you enter there, you don't feel that you are encroaching on private property. These are semi-private spaces. It's public and private at the same time, but deeply branded, right?
Right.
So it's the founding of Disneyland was all about the merger of ABC and to manifest this urban park. Or you look at Angry Birds. I mean, Angry Bird parks have just come up in China, and it's not a coincidence. It's a sort of the space. The urban space is almost like an extension of the larger marketing plan of, you know, Angry Birds, the great Finnish video gaming and the app sensation, which has been downloaded a billion times. So, it's something that we are experiencing is most spaces are now semi-private in nature with the impressions of publicness.
Mm-hmm.
A constant negotiation between to what extent can it be public, and this will be a dialectical relationship, I would say, you know.
Mm-hmm. And you talk about Disney in one of the later chapters of the book, I believe, on virtual spaces, and you talk about the Disneyfication of virtual spaces. Mm-hmm. Online as well. Now, I'm wondering also, and one of the things I should tell you that I really enjoyed is that you do look at this metaphor from an international perspective and not completely focusing on the West and, I guess, what's considered the global North. And so I think it's important to look at parks all over the world. And so one of my questions is, when you do look at the idea of parks and public spaces all over the world with respect to this metaphor, is there or are there some conflicts that are not resolved with how the publics in those different spaces view these particular spaces? So how perhaps America versus, I'd even say, the Netherlands versus China versus India view these public spaces and how they should be used, and then how does that transfer to the web?
It's a great question because, in some regards, I've been trying to show the commonalities, because what's tempting is, and what's dominant in today's approach to emerging markets versus the West, is the division of practices, mm-hmm. as if people in the West behave significantly differently from those in emerging markets, because after all, if you're poor and you're a farmer, wouldn't you rather be checking crop prices than playing a video game, right? So how can you learn much from their practices, or how can you connect it? So mm-hmm. I've actually done the reverse thing. No, actually, from my field work, over a decade, a lot of what I've found in rural parts of India, from the Himalayas to the from the north to the south, was the fact that in spite of their lower economic status, the poor are just in slums or in rural areas are just as much desiring to play video games, download music, watch movies. They've got on Orkut, which is, the social network site in India, just booming, but I think Facebook is taking over. That to me was more of the underlying, is that there's much more in common. But that said, of course there are different issues. Like you have, the Chinese firewall. So the whole walled garden metaphor mm-hmm. in China looks rather different than, say, the walled garden in the U.S., which is more about, every time we like a particular political party, then the sort of it creates even more of a division, say, between the Republicans and the Democrats. You get into that sort of filter bubble or echo chamber, right, as what people are talking about. Mm-hmm. So that's a different kind of conversation, because more from people being indirectly, worked on by the media, whether it's Fox or ABC, and then it filters through and, manifests in their actions, right? Mm-hmm. Versus in China, it is very state-driven, saying, well, you can't even, you can't Google Tiananmen Square, you can't Google a lot of actually issues and topics. Basically, good parts of the history is invisible. And so it pushes the citizen to behaving much more creatively to circumvent state regulations, and censorship. So you definitely see the sort of the creativity manifest in very different ways, mm-hmm. but there is creative acts by citizens, whether it's China or the U.S.
Right. So we're talking about the book, The Leisure Commons, A Spatial History of Web 2.0. If you wanted the audience for New Books in Technology to know perhaps one or two important things about this new book, what would those be?
Well, let's see. I would say the most important thing is to understand that we can't talk about, the digital spaces online and offline. It's such an old conversation, but people seem to be stuck, I think. Mm-hmm. They know you can't speak in these divisive terms, and yet they don't know how to bring them together. Mm-hmm. Because I keep hearing people still talking about them in separate ways. So what I would say is, if people are really looking to engage with these new digital spaces, but are sort of averse to going into that believe that these are very divided, still, I would really recommend, going into this book, because it really bridges the urban and the digital in ways which are not just transnational, but is deeply historical. Mm-hmm. Because after all, our social acts are not just manifested from today, but it is reproduced, over time. It's influenced by our historic practices. So I would say that to me is the core of it. And particularly if you want to know how these spaces are conceptualized and how they are architected, and really fun facts, you know, whether the factory garden, there's a lot of buzzwords out there, like digital labor. Mm-hmm. And I mean, it's so much fun to actually go back in the 1800s and say, hang on, what Google is doing today and offering these leisure spaces, like, you know, the Google Park to work in, but actually enhancing productivity. You can see in the 1800s in the factory gardens where they were hiring, you know, the architects who architected Central Park for the same corporate space, factory space, so they could enhance labor. So, you know, there's a lot of great examples that sort of humbles us and makes us realize that these have deep historical precedents, and it's not necessary that Web 2.0 is all that novel after all.
Mm-hmm. So if we wanted to read more from you, do you have your own website?
Yes, it's at, well, my name, www.pileaurora.com, not too hard. Of course, if you can't spell that name, then it's just going to go somewhere very different. So great. It's my first and last name.com.
Yeah. And if we want to know what's next for me, what's next?
Well, my colleague from India, Nimi Rangaswamy, she's at Xerox, and myself, we just signed a contract with Harvard University Press on a book called The Poor at Play, Digital Life Beyond the West, which is, you know, some of what I've actually been talking about is how people in emerging markets are really fundamentally playing, engaging with entertainment, you know, pornography, and they have different concepts of privacy than, you know, and they probably never heard of Edward Snowden. They're like, Edward who? You know, so, and so these are the kind of conversations you want to bring out and say, if the majority of the world lie outside the West and they are often poor and in slums or in favelas in Brazil, let's put that to the center of internet conversation. So that's our new, well, our forthcoming book.
Sounds good. So this has been New Books in Technology, and the book is The Leisure Commons, A Spatial History of Web 2.0. Pyle, thank you for coming on the show. And ladies and gentlemen, we'll see you next time.